Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 47. This week, we talk with Min Mong about microcontroller mayhem and remote control lawnmowers. Lots of awesome Windows 10 announcements. And Windows 10 coming to Android phones. Hey, today we have Min Mong. He is a software developer for Skyline Technologies. He's a user group leader for the Lake County .NET Users Group. And he's organizer for the Chicago Code Camp and that conference. How's it going, Min?
It's going pretty well. Glad to be on the show.
Yeah, welcome to the show. So let's see. How's it going, Carl?
It's going pretty good. Long time no see.
Yeah. So what do you got going up? I see you got something this weekend.
Well, not this weekend. Next weekend. Actually, all three of us are going to be speaking at the new Code Camp. So Northeast Wisconsin Code Camp. If anybody's in the area, it's a Code Camp for developers, not any specific platform or technology or anything like that. There's going to be all sorts of cool stuff. I'll be talking about Windows Live Tiles. What are you talking about, Jason?
I am talking about IoT. It's not just a buzzword. There's some really cool stuff. So I recommend checking that out. And Min, what are you going to be talking about?
I'll be talking on portable class libraries and how to consume them in, you know, all multi-platform development, as well as consuming data from MVC websites, such as Web API and OAuth.
Awesome. I will be there. And we have a birthday. Happy 17th birthday, Curl. Not Carl, Curl.
I was going to say, it's not my birthday.
Yeah, don't get confused. So happy 17th birthday. I just thought I'd shout out to Curl. That's pretty cool. That's been set around 17 years, and it's pretty influential on all the different platforms and very handy. Carl, what do we have for feedback?
This week, we got a bunch of 5-star reviews on iTunes. We'd like to thank everybody who does that. It really does mean a lot to us. It really bumps us up in their standings. So if you want to get mentioned on the show, send us an email to feedback@msdevshow.com. Comment to us on Facebook, iTunes, Stitcher. Like I said, we really like the iTunes reviews. Help spread the word about the show.
Thank you for those reviews. We really appreciate it. Okay, so what's going on this week? MS Dev Show early reach of our goal. So yeah, we had set a goal. Actually, you thought I was crazy. I had set a goal, what, about 9 months ago, 10 months ago?
Yep, right after we saw what the first episode or two was. You basically said we should hit 20% growth every month, and then after that was over, a little bit extra bump to get to 50,000 downloads within the first year. And we are
we've blown past that.
We're almost 3 months away from our first year, and we are already way past that. So we'd like to thank everybody for downloading it, listening to it, mentioning it to your coworkers and friends.
Yep. We're just having a good time here, and we really appreciate everybody listening. Okay, let's see. We got MS Build on GitHub. Did you see this one, Carl?
I did hear about it.
This is awesome.
There's a 2-day virtual conference put on by Microsoft that you could watch on Channel 9 this past week. And this was, you know, one of the many announcements that they had this week. A lot of news that came out of that. And this was pretty big. You want to cover a little bit more about it, Jason? I don't know quite as much about MS Build as you do.
Well, I don't consider myself an MS Build expert. I like to push build and just have things work. But I think a lot of people didn't realize, though, that you could jump into the XML file, you know, the build file for your project, and you could actually modify that. And it actually is a pretty extensive build system. You could use this before using like MS Build. I had used Enant. And there's some other build systems out there for running, you know, tasks and sort of a procedural order, or I think you can even do some stuff in parallel in here. But this is all open source, and you know, there's nothing particularly amazing that I want to use in here because it's open source now. But I know like things like Mono can take advantage of this. So that's great. Making that open source and you know, just getting to where things should be. So it's just another step in that direction.
It's pretty cool that, you know, Microsoft is going the open source route these days.
Yeah.
In the past, past year or so.
Yeah. And I hope that's kind of the default going forward. You know, my opinion is, you know, things we should always start with that open by default thinking, unless there, you know, sometimes there are constraints and there's reasons why it can't be open source. That's fine. But that should be the exception, not the rule. And we're seeing a real trend toward that. So that's great. Dad and the 10 Commandments of Egoless Programming.
Yeah, this was actually an older blog post. It was written about 3 years ago, And it was advice that this guy, as he was, you know, finishing up a computer science degree, got from his dad, who was, you know, about 40 years older than him, who worked in the industry. Mm-hmm. And what I thought was interesting is a lot of this advice is stuff that, you know, people are talking about now, like it's fresh. And this is something that, you know, somebody who has 40 years of experience in the field was giving out. You know, it's stuff like, you are not your code, you know,
right.
I see that a lot of times. It happens to me. You know, I write something that's really awesome and somebody just kind of tears it up a bit. And it, you know, it is no reflection of me.
Yeah.
It's reflection of the code itself.
Or the realization that you need to just delete all the code that you worked on for the past week. You know, I think mature developers ultimately, see that as a good thing. But you see a lot of developers that they really take that personally and they hang on to that code. And I just think that's just a bad idea. And I think that's a real sign of maturity when you can let that go.
Yeah. You know, and another piece of advice skipping down is, you know, don't be the coder in the corner, you know, be out, be social, you know, not saying that you got to go out and, you know, like all three of us, you know, be on a podcast, go out speaking or anything, but, you know, just talk to other people, you know, go out, you know, for a break, you know, have a beverage with somebody and just take the time to, you know, not be stuck in your monitor all day.
Right. Right. Cool. Yeah. This is all really good advice. Like you said, it's just timeless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The next piece of news, I'm going to put a little bit of backstory on. I was talking to somebody this week who, you know, I don't know the exact name of this, but he's from Europe and he writes or he has a website that essentially in English translates to Windows News. And he created an app. He created an app that had basically submitted Windows News in whatever language he natively speaks. Well, it kept getting denied from the store because that technically violates Microsoft's intellectual property. So as part of, you know, communicating with them and somebody else found a link that brought up, this is what Microsoft trademarks there are. This is the intellectual property that Microsoft legally has the rights to. And they put it all on one web page for you to just kind of quick go through. And they even went through the trouble to put it into a bunch of different translations too. So if English isn't your native, they have, you know, the top translations to go through. So they even have, you know, you can jump down to the alphabet. So they own the rights to Tahoma for the font or
right.
TrueSkill. I don't even know what that is, but it even goes and says if they own the registered trademark or just a trademark or whatever. So
the heck is Joanna Dark. Oh, it's a character. That's interesting.
Yeah. But either way, I mean, if you do have, you know, an app or something that you're making, it will get denied from the store if it contains, some of this intellectual property on there, just even the name of it. So, this is something that obviously would have helped this guy out. Unfortunately, you know, he can't have it match up with his website, which is fairly popular.
It's like that guy that's named Mike Rowe Soft. Or no, it was Mike Rowe, and he made a company called Microsoft. Yeah, I looked in this list too. I wanted to see if MS was in here, and it is not, thankfully, because that was one of my concerns with the name of the show.
well, actually, when we did start the show, you did run our first logo and a few questions by legal.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep. I mean, we did clear that we wouldn't be violating anything, and we could continue ourselves as the MS Dev Show.
Right.
But it's interesting that, you know, I thought that when you submit an app on Windows stores, they validate and make sure that, you know, it's an open available name, but they wouldn't check it against the, you know, infringement stuff. The trademark.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. It's probably just a, you know, left hand, right hand thing. I mean, whoever wrote that one page, you know, didn't implement that functionality or it's on the backlog or whatever. So then it just gets the Slack gets picked up by, you know, whoever is validating the applications. Okay. CSS Sans. What is this about, Carl? You put this in here and I'm totally confused.
So this is a font written entirely in CSS.
Okay.
So this is a Sans style font. If you have the CSS and you can download the CSS styles, and you just put like div class equals A and just self end that, it'll actually put A styled in this font on there. And what's also cool about the demo page is they show you exactly which rules draw which part of the font. So if you look at A, for example, you can actually hover over the they have a .a colon before and a .a colon after. And the A is actually just the horizontal line connecting the two slants, whereas the before is the leading slant and A is the trailing or the after is the trailing slant. And you can do that for all of these. You can see what rules, you know, how they actually physically draw the lines on there. So I don't know.
This isn't actually useful, cool. Right? I mean, nobody would actually use this, would they?
You know, I wouldn't say nobody. I don't say nobody. Tool. I don't say nobody would ever do it because.
Well, should they do it?
I don't think anybody probably should do
okay.
it. But I do think it's cool that, you know, you can go and create not just letters out there, but a very consistent looking font. I mean, this.
Right, right.
Everything looks like it should go together. And once again, I just thought it looked interesting. So I put that out there. If you want to see how they did it, go to CSS Sans link on our show notes.
Yep. So just don't do this. Just go look how they did it. We're going to see, you know, like a pull request to the MS Dev Show, like replacing all of our fonts with like the CSS font.
Denied.
Yep. Okay. And then we got tons of Windows 10 stuff. So what do we got first here?
The first one is... I think these next several links come from WinHack, which was put on in China. So these are announcements that Microsoft gave off. And the first link that we'll have and talk about is a slide deck from the WinHack presentation about Windows 10 and the phone minimum requirements. I think this is kind of cool. I mean, there's not really a whole lot to pull out of here from a developer, but as somebody who has a Windows phone and really likes them, as well as, you know, tablets and other devices... one of the things that we find is Microsoft is supporting new system on a chips, not just more Qualcomm stuff, because up until now, it's just been all Qualcomm processors. But there's also going to be some Intel and AMD processors that they're going to be able to support on phones.
OK,
some of the cool things, I'm not going to go over all of these, but I did think that it was interesting that they showed what the supported resolutions are. And they only mentioned that they didn't put they didn't put a cap on the higher end of the resolution. They just said that if you have a resolution of 2560 by 2048 or higher, you have to have at least 4 gigs of memory in a phone. And I just think that would be one, an awesome display, but two, you know, you get 4 gigs in a phone, you know, compared to current hardware, that's definitely steps forward.
Right. Right.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, can you go through the other 25 slides, please? No, it's but we'll have a link to this in the show notes. There's actually a lot of cool. I mean, if you're into the actual hardware and requirements, this is actually kind of a cool deck.
Yeah.
And then what's next? Let's see here. USB mass storage peripherals and hubs. So I'm going to hook a hard drive up to my phone. Is that what's going on?
Potentially.
Okay.
I think one of the cool things with this too is, you know, Windows 10 phones won't be just a an endpoint on a USB, they can also be the hub as well.
Right.
So you can use it to connect to your computer to use it as storage and shovel things on and off. But you could also potentially hook a keyboard up to it, or like you said, mass storage, and get that transfer that way.
Okay. They even show a monitor here. So, I mean,
yeah,
that's true. I mean, over USB, you can hook up monitors. So I've seen this happen. You know, I have like the Dell Venue 8 tablet, and you can, over USB, you can hook up a hub, and I've seen people run like quad monitors off of that thing with the USB video drivers and then a mouse and keyboard. So you could theoretically do the same thing with your phone.
Yep. And, there's also support for USB type C, which is, you can use for high bandwidth. You can use for power, mm-hmm. Famously recently Apple's new MacBook, that's the only port on there. But well, I mean, it goes to show that this feature alone will be able to bring quite a few things. I had a kind of a joking back and forth between somebody on Twitter this week when I posted the link to this. He's like, oh, I'm really excited for this. I'm like, yeah, I can't wait to be able to flip my USB in either way.
Yeah.
And he's like, you have a supercomputer with your pocket, you could plug anything in, and you're excited about which way you can flip, you know, plug it in.
Yeah. Well, something I got to do every day.
Yeah. But really both things are big. I mean, you could potentially have a supercomputer in your pocket and you get to work and just put it into a dock via that USB-C port and be able to hook a monitor and other hardware in there.
Yeah.
Especially, and that is pretty cool.
Yeah. Especially with Office running on the phone. I mean, it runs fast on there. And with the full document fidelity, I mean, for a lot of people that's actually getting close to what they need. It's sort of getting back to that. I think it was like Samsung, or they had the Atrix or whatever. You could plug it in and power a monitor in that. And I don't know if that was any good, but you know, the further we get into the future here, the more viable that becomes. So the difference in power between the phone and the desktop just becomes more meaningless as we go.
Yep. All you'll need is pretty much a keyboard and a mouse.
Yeah.
If even, right?
Yeah. And then heck, there's places you go. I mean, where there's already monitors, or you're in a hotel room and you have a TV, right? And it's 1080p and you just hook up an HDMI cable.
I know you've been waiting for that for a long time.
Yeah. So I haven't talked about this on the show, but I bought this, I'm going to go on a total tangent here, but I bought a 15-foot HDMI cable and I bought it off of Monoprice. And at first I had bought a Miracast adapter, the Microsoft Miracast adapter. And as expected, I left it in the first hotel I stayed in, because the problem with it is you plug it into the HDMI port behind a TV and you can't see it. So
when you leave, forget about it.
Yeah. So you leave the hotel and you never, you know, you look around and you don't see the thing. So I bought a 15-foot cable and I searched for ultra thin. So it's like super thin. It weighs nothing. It can barely feel it when you're holding onto it. And the way that they do it, since you cannot within spec of an HDMI cable that thin, what they've done is they've actually put a chip in each end of the cable. They call it this red mirror technology. And the cable becomes one directional. So you can, the ends are labeled. One says two TV and one says two PC or whatever, even though it works with whatever, but it sends the video, audio, all of that. And what's awesome is you can sit down in a hotel room, plug that into your device and then go plug it into the TV and you have zero lag, you know, over like Miracast. You will get, you know, 100 milliseconds of lag is very perceptible whenever you're talking video or whenever you're trying to move your cursor around. So this lets you extend that monitor. So it's kind of a pro tip for people, is to go out to Monoprice and get one of those red mirror cables. I love mine. Move on, Carl, to the next one. What do we got here? Microsoft wants to see speedier updates for Windows 10 phones. Well, everybody does, but this is Project Milky Way.
Yeah. And there's not a whole lot here, you know, details wise, but it officially releases that they have a goal that when they have an update for your phone, that everybody will be able to get it within 4 to 6 weeks. And we know right now with the carriers, I mean, there's still people waiting on Denim for Nokia and stuff like that. Yeah, and it's like
the
that.
Carriers holding it up.
And
so,
it is.
So what would happen? I just like to see this happen, but this is probably like, you know, a horrible legal battle. What would happen if Microsoft just like flipped a switch and they just updated everybody's phones?
Yeah.
Just bypassing the carriers.
Yeah, I have no idea. But this is a little bit of speculation on my part, you know, doing some research into actually, you know, how and what they can, you know, push in an update. Mm-hmm. There's different, like, you know, in Windows, there's different rings in the OS. You have like ring zero, which is the, you know, all the super low level stuff. And as they go up higher, you increment the numbers. As far as I understand, when it comes to whatever ring they're changing, the higher up it is the easier it is to get through the carrier. Mm-hmm. So what I'm assuming here is Microsoft's trying to push as much as they can into those higher levels to make them easier to bypass through these carrier testing.
Okay.
So that is an assumption on my part. So I just like to put that out there as a warning, but
yeah, it is really cool that they're putting the developer preview program was like sort of a way around that too, right? Right.
Yeah.
So just using that whole thing where it's like, wink, wink, you know, get into our developer preview program, get into this different ring.
I think it's just different. Yep. I mean, like all I was saying, it's just different levels and how much is it going to impact the system? Because if you look at Apple, I mean, Apple, since, you know, they push out every few months.
Right. And they're totally able to bypass it. Right.
Right.
Yeah. But I just think this is huge for a lot of people, you know, just being able to know that if they buy a Windows phone, they can be on whatever's current.
Cool. Let's see here. Microsoft is developing a ROM that converts Android phones to Windows 10. This is cool. How does this work?
This was huge. Microsoft announced that they've been developing along with a Chinese carrier, or not carrier, but device maker, Xiaomi, that they're working that of creating ROMs for existing Android phones that you just install the ROM and you get Windows 10, not some funky Android that looks like Windows 10, but you will get Windows 10 for phone.
Yeah. So what was keeping this from working previously? Cause it's always like there's like some magic to getting a different operating system on a phone. Cause like you have the M8 and I know that there's an Android variant, but you can't flash Android on your phone. Can you?
Correct. I cannot do that.
So
that
is something that they have actually to do. Different about it?
They didn't go into details on that, but they did say that it will be up to the consumer to be able to acquire and put that down, you know, install it. So I'm assuming it's going to be a lot like how a current Android user has to go to some shady website.
Yeah.
Except this shady website will be Microsoft.com.
Okay. Anything else you want to say on that?
No, I just think that's really awesome and could lead to a lot of people moving to the Windows Phone community.
Well, heck yeah. I mean, if I had an Android phone, well, actually, I do have one here. I have one of every kind. But I mean, I would just try, if I was an Android person and didn't try Windows Phone, I mean, that's a cool way to try it for a week, 2 weeks, 30 days.
Yeah. And then put your old ROM back on.
Yeah.
I mean, the crazy thing is this. I've seen it earlier in the days of Android when you used to have, you can buy a HTC HD or something like that, and you can, it's a Windows mobile device, so it's pre-Windows Phone, and you can flash not only Windows Phone 7, but also Android OS on it, and it was working one-directional. Now this sounds like it's going to be bi-directional, which is going to be really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to understand what the magic is that makes it like locked to one OS, if it's something in like the bootloader or how that works. Cause that seems almost like anti-competitive. Although, you know, like we said with the M8, I mean, it's the same hardware vendor. So, you know, they obviously don't care. So very interesting. Okay. So let's get into questions. Let's talk to Min. So how's it going, Min?
Going pretty good.
So you've worked on a whole bunch of really cool stuff. I've seen some of your videos and looked at some of your projects, and they're pretty awesome, actually. So I'm really excited to be talking to you.
Well, it's more like, you know, mad science experiments gone right.
Yeah.
Half the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know. Yeah. I know. I've seen a lot of your stuff, and that's definitely has that vibe. So, you know, you do a lot of robotics work, for example. So kind of let's start from the beginning. You know, how did you like what got you into that? What drove you to do that?
Well, when I was a kid, my brother came home one day and said, hey, you know, I was over at my, you know, our dad's friend's house, and, you know, I saw this really cool robot. And then since then, I've just been kind of like digging about my toys and, you know, trying to figure out how things work. And then I would just make, you know, statues of egg cartons that look like robots or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And then my first real experience with, you know, actual messing with, you know, electronics and software together is probably in my college years when I was doing my degree with distinctions project. So I was making a robotic controlled arm. It was just, I bought a kit online, and it all it had is like a pretty much like a joystick, and you can move the motors up and down, and it would just power it up. However, I wanted to interface to it using a Windows mobile device at that time. So it's like a, you know, one of those BDA devices at that time. And how I hooked it, and what I used at that time was I used a microcontroller called Basic Stem 2, and it was written in Basic language. The interesting thing at that time was I didn't know enough about the, I got the project to work, but I didn't know enough about how the different possibilities I could use with it. So the way I was communicating from the pocket PC to the microcontroller was via a infrared light.
Okay.
And each command, the first command would be really fast because I would do like one blast at a time. However, as the commands get longer, and you know, I'm doing the 10th command, then I need like 100 command, you know, 100 flashes of light to decode through, and it would take forever. So, but you know, that's the first project that actually got me hooked into the microcontroller stuff.
Okay. How'd you actually hook the chip up then to the controller? Cause I, you know, that's kind of the hard part for me starting. Like I do some IoT stuff, and I can get sensors working with certain things, but you know, to actually tear something like that apart, like I saw the arm you were talking about, and yeah, you're right. It had like the, like, you know, little like remote control car, remote with it that I think was, it was hardwired in, right? The remote was,
it was hardwired in.
Correct. Yeah. So you take apart that remote, and, you know, how did you actually wire the controller into that then?
So I pretty much what I did was I took the remote control apart, and in the back, I figured out which points on the circuit board, actually, if I touch them together, it, you know,
completes the circuit. By closing the circuit, correct. It's actually doing it. Okay.
Right. So I interfaced it with a bunch of I think I interfaced it with maybe like 9 relays at that time.
Okay.
So if I'm sending commands, I can actually hear the things go click, 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 click all the way through, which is cool. Relays are nice if you want to do basic stuff, but you know, you really have to watch out for what the load is and what the amperage is for triggering those relays as well.
Right.
So how much does something like this, like a small project like this, cost you, not just in money, but in time as well? Because I know a lot of people like me, you know, I don't have a whole lot of free time because I've got a bunch of kids, and because I have a bunch of kids, I don't have a lot of money, you know, but I still want to do this stuff. This stuff always has sounded interesting to me. What kind of investment do I have to make in both those aspects?
If I were to start today, I would pick a Arduino microcontroller. They are everywhere, and you can actually go to, you know, Fry's, or there you go, Jason. He just showed me.
I just showed one on the camera. Yeah.
They're very cheap. You don't have to buy a Arduino brand one. You can get a clone version of it, and those run as low as like $10. So start with that. That will actually start with that. With always get a breadboard and some LEDs. So that way you can actually figure out if something's working or not. Because you don't have a monitor in front of you, so you can't debug as well as you want to.
All right, so let's just break this apart just so I make sure everybody understands. So if I get an Arduino, that's what I can write my code against and load it onto my Arduino, and the code will run.
Correct.
And then a breadboard is what?
A breadboard is it looks like, in theory, it looks like bread. It's a little plastic. It's a little block of plastic. It's got a bunch of rails connected to it underneath. However, on the plastic, it's got a bunch of holes. So they go by columns at a time. So one column would be holes. Any pins that you put into that thing, they will be all connected in one column.
So it's kind of a cheater way to wire something together, but not have to have it like soldered and be permanent.
Correct. It's a perfect prototyping tool. So I usually have I have one that is about 2 inches big. I also have a different breadboard that's about 3 inches by about, I don't know, 6 or 7 inches in dimensions. It's bigger, but it also gives me a lot more freedom in terms of the number of accessories I'm connecting to it and stuff like that. So it's a great way. You don't need to worry about soldering. You just have to make sure that you have a few wires. So that's another thing that you want to buy, wiring, you know, just a set of wires that you can buy on Amazon for like $5.
Yeah, I think I've seen kits that's like a breadboard plus a ton of wires and all that stuff for, just a few bucks.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't worry about getting like LCDs when you're just starting off, because that stuff gets really complex if you don't know what you're doing, or you get a really simple LCD that does a serial communication for you on that thing.
All right, so just to get started, it would just be, you know, that Arduino or other similar kind of controller, something to make my wiring easier, and then maybe just a couple of LEDs or other random sensors, a grab bag perhaps. I know they have those at like SparkFun and stuff like that.
Right.
And then just kind of figure it out and just play with what you have.
Exactly. If you want to do something like, you know, handle like motion and stuff like that, in terms of if you want to control a motor and stuff like that, there's two routes that you can go with. One is you can get something called like a motor, a stepper motor driver or a motor driver. It's a costly approach, or you can get a relay. And the thing with the relays is it's either on or off. So you'll hear it. And you don't want to drop the relays because some of them are pretty sensitive and you could break them. However, the motor controller chips are not as sensitive. You know, they're all solid state.
I'm sensing that you've broken some.
Yes, I've not only broken some, I've smelled some. and they have burned my finger too. Because the thing with the motor controllers is you need to make sure that your motor has a certain amperage load that it will suck out of the circuit. And if you have a big motor and it's taking about, I don't know, 20 amps, and you're using a motor controller that is only meant for 1 amp, you will definitely burn it out in like a matter of seconds.
I thought that was the cologne that you were wearing, but I guess it's just the smell of burnt electronics I always smell.
You will sell. You don't want to ask my wife.
All right. Speaking of your relatives, I know your brother Lewin as well, and I know that he's got a lot of very similar interests. How does having, you know, a geeky brother like that help you with these projects?
Actually, we kind of, you know, thrive off of each other. You know, we pit each other against, you know, different tasks and different projects. So if I, you know, if I don't have, well, another thing is it also helps with the budgeting wise.
Oh yeah, that's a good point.
So one good project that the two of us actually started to get into after my robotic arm experience was my robotic lawn mower. The whole thing runs on two power wheel toy cars. So right. those are the little cars that, you know, the kids drive on, right?
They're actually pretty strong.
They're very strong. Each one can carry my brother who is pretty hefty, and that's one nice way of saying it. It will move him along. It won't be super fast, but it will move him along. However, with two of them put together, the load's a lot lighter, and it will move him along at a fairly good speed. That is without us overclocking it or, you know, overpowering it. Mm-hmm. So we started with that project, and I chipped in for one of the power wheels, and my brother wanted to. He's like, well, I don't think one's going to be enough. It barely moves me. We're going to get two of them, and let's see what happens. So we ended up buying two of them. And before I knew it, we had a whole garage full of like four or five of these power wheel cars.
Yeah, I think – I can't remember if it was you or your brother. You were talking about going to a garage, or it was like on Craigslist or garage sale or something, and you ended up buying a whole bunch of power wheels for this project.
That's my brother.
Yeah.
I came home one day from work, and he's like, guess what I got in my car? And he has like two of them stacked, and there's like two in the garage. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Oh, the kids will have fun. Oh, those are for us. Okay.
Right.
That's awesome.
At the end of the day, what we ended up taking is just the gear shaft. I mean, pretty much the motor and the gear. We didn't even keep the pedal controls. We just kept the batteries, the gears, and the wheels. That's all we kept. And we made a whole new frame out of PVC piping. And it's pretty much a rectangle with a hollow thing in the middle. That way we can put our lawnmower in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So we will take the wheels off the lawnmower and we'll drop it into the middle of it. And we'll attach it with some screws, right? So that's what the initial design of that was.
So most people, you know, push around their lawnmower, but not you.
Well, I mean, I have a pretty big lawn, and you know, there's one area by the road where it can be a little bit, you know, gnarly, that, you know, there are rocks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't like getting things, you know, rocks sent to my shins. It hurts. So, so, you know, nothing better than controlling with a, you know, phone.
Yeah. So that was the first iteration. Then what modifications did you make after that?
Well, the first iteration used, relays.
Yeah.
And then within a week, we changed the iteration to have the motor controllers. We were running, and it was running pretty well. We spent about $70 on a nice motor controller. We're running around, and that's actually a funny story, because at that time, we're using a Atom computer laptop on the vehicle, and we were controlling it via Wi-Fi to our phones, and over time it got out of range, and the vehicle would just keep going. And when you see that it's going,
so an automated death machine,
right? When you see that it's going and it's about to enter into my neighbor's yard and then go over the road, you freak out, you drop the phone, and you run after it, and you just start unplugging wires off of the thing.
Yeah.
So in a different instance of that, we ran out of range and it hit one of the trees, and it pretty much burned out one of our motor controllers.
Yeah.
That's when we realized that this, you know, this little hobby that we just started, it's expensive. But we ended up spending it. So to overcome that, we started adding fuses to it. That way, you know, if the load goes over a certain amperage, it will burn the fuse out, which is cheaper. Idea. Also, we ended up putting in over $160 worth of motor controllers into that thing afterwards.
Okay. So do you still use that thing today?
We still use it. We have different platforms for it. One for presentation mode, which actually shoots Nerf darts.
Yeah.
Another one where we actually would drive it to our Coke cans and stuff like that, and it will haul, you know, cans of Coke and stuff like that. That way I don't have to lift it from the, you know, parking lot all the way into the building.
You know, that's actually, this thing is sounding pretty useful, right? Because once you have this remote control, you know, like sort of generic vehicle, right? That's awesome. If you can sort of plug in the mower, or you can, you know, just put like a cooler on it or boxes.
Right.
Put your brother on it, you know, hook up a Nerf gun. That's awesome.
And the great thing is it will go on almost any terrains, and it's it doesn't have its steering wheel, so it's pretty much like a tank. So it will turn on the spot to, you know, any direction that you want, and you can go off from that.
That is really cool. So can you, like, is there a video camera on it so you can sort of sit around and drive it from the camera, or do you have to watch it?
We have a camera on that one. So because the first iteration we had the camera on it because it was running a WCF service on there. Mm-hmm. And it was capturing the webcam pictures, and it was just saving them. And then whenever I was on the mobile device, I was just calling those images up. So depending on how fast I'm pulling at it, it looks almost like real feed.
Okay.
It's cheating. It's not true streaming, but, you know, it gets the job done.
Yeah. I'm just thinking that'd be really cool to have a camera maybe mounted up a little bit with kind of a wide field of view. So, you know, you safety first, right? So you can see if anybody gets in the way or any pets or anything, but you could just sit there and mow your lawn that way. That'd be pretty fun.
Yeah. Well, the best part is, you know, when we were prototyping and testing this thing in the front of my yard, my neighbor was actually watering her plants, and she saw us driving this thing around and
just
mowing
like,
the grass.
Oh no, not again!
And she pretty much just kept staring, and she pretty much didn't do anything. She was frozen for like a few minutes, and it was the best experience. Because the main reason I did this thing is not because I was lazy; it's because I got tired of her son getting on a tractor lawnmower and going around zip 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 on his front yard and going back in within 5 minutes.
Yeah.
While I'm doing this thing for 30 minutes at the front yard.
Oh man. That thing is awesome. I gotta see that thing mowing the lawn sometime. Do you have a video of that up or not?
I do not have a video of that one mowing the lawn.
I saw the video where you were like you had weaponized it and you were shooting something.
Yes.
And then also your brother got on it and you were driving it around.
Yeah. Right now, if I take a video of it, the frame's a little bit dirty right now, so I'll have to clean it up.
Okay, cool.
So can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, your weaponized remote control vehicle? You know, I mean, you said that you bring it to presentations. You know, what do you do with it, you know, other than just let everybody take a turn shooting things?
Yeah, and you said it's all the same frame, right?
Correct.
You just have a module?
It's on different frames. We just take the motors up and the microcontroller off of it.
Okay.
So back to the different iterations. The second iteration, we moved out of a computer and we put on a Arduino with the Ethernet and a router on it. Mm-hmm. So it uses a lot less power, and, you know, it's a little bit quicker to control. Mm-hmm. The current iteration's now on an Arduino and it's running on a Wi-Fi chip. So we bring the whole unit out, and normally what we present on is like Arduino 101, pretty much to get people interested in it and show them the basics, like, you know, for example, how to control motors with a motor controller, for example, and how it's simple and it doesn't take that long to, you know, figure out the math and everything else to get what you need done. Mm-hmm. And then we show that, you know, within a few weeks you can get from a microcontroller of just blinking lights all the way to controlling it pretty much a radio control car.
Yeah, and fully weaponized.
Right, fully weaponized, of course.
So how did you hook that up?
I found this.
And it's Nerf. It's a Nerf gun for the listeners,
right? It's a Nerf Vulcan, and the good thing is Nerf already has most of the electronics hooked for you. Mm-hmm. It uses a, I believe it uses like a 7-volt combination. it uses C-cell batteries, but when you put them in together, it comes out to be like 7 or 9 volts.
Okay.
And the trigger is pretty much completing the circuitry. So
you don't have to physically pull the trigger. You can just
I can just short it out. I can, yep. Yeah. That's what we ended up doing. And instead of using a 9-volt trigger, a 9-volt battery, we just hooked it up to a 12-volt so that it shoots a little bit faster and farther.
There you go. So we'll link the video of that in the show notes. That was pretty awesome.
Thanks.
So when I was talking to Jason before the show, he had mentioned that you had made your own circuit boards and had them etched. So I was wondering, you know, one, what's that process like? And two, you know, how do you know when to kind of go from, you know, you take your breadboarding to something a little bit more permanent? You know, how do you take that and know when is it the right time to go to your own circuit board?
That's a really good question, because when is the right time?
Well, you know, I'm looking at this as a software engineer. I mean, I've done a lot of software stuff. When I was in the military, I did a lot of hardware stuff, but that was kind of all two totally different parts of my lives. And looking at it back from the software side, you know, I understand that, okay, I have the controller that does stuff. I need to wire it to do things. And, you know, there, I understand that printing that circuit board, you know, is, you know, wiring things up. You know, why did you at least make your decisions to make your circuit boards and get them etched?
So the Arduino boards that you normally get, it's pretty much for really good for like quick starting and prototyping. So they have a bunch of GPIO pins open, and you can just connect little wires into those holes and connect to the breadboard, which is great. However, if you're putting it on, let's just say, a motorized vehicle and that's running, you know, out of control, things could get loose if it's running over, you know, if it's running over a different thing. So the wiring can get loose. If I'm taking it to somebody's house to show what I'm doing, it could get loose, and I will have to figure out, you know, where I plug the wires in, because I may not have the whole circuitry, you know, hand drawn out and, you know, memorized by heart. So my best approach is I would prototype it, test it out a few times, make sure that I don't want to add any more additional components to it. If I do, I would make sure that I will have at least four options, a few options, X amount of options that you need ported out, meaning I would draw out different pins so that you can solder additional stuff onto it if needed. So I will have maybe like one or two additional digital connectors and a few analogs so that I can control like, you know, strobe lights for the vehicle or a light sensor, you know, to figure out if it's dark enough in the daytime. And if it's, you know, if it's too dark outside, then I'll use a second digital port and turn the lights on in the vehicle, for example. So it's just about scalability, and you want to plan that little bits of it out ahead of time, but you don't need to implement it right then and there. That's how I would normally do it. And so when you have most of your idea flushed out, as in, it's pretty much working the way you want, but you might want to, you know, you might want to leave a few things open. That's how I normally approach my projects. And then I would start doing the whole etching process on my own. I would never draw a circuit board diagram and send it to a shop. Actually, I lied, because I did that, and it's a very costly mistake. You will want to do it a few times and make sure that it is the way that you want. Obviously, there's going to be times when the circuit boards get complicated, meaning it's not just one-sided. It could be double-sided, or it could be three layers. Mm-hmm. It becomes really complex.
So you mentioned drawing this. Is there some sort of like standard tool or, you know, output that you have to generate when you do have something that you want? You know, how does that work? How easy is it?
I use this thing called CatSoft. I use this software called Eagle by CatSoft, actually. It's a very simple, it looks very intimidating, it's very simple to use. I would say look online, look on YouTube, follow a few tutorials on how to do it. I can probably look up a link for you and give it to you after the show. So that way you can put it on the website as well on how to put these together. that's how I started mine. And there was a really good tutorial that I went through, maybe like 10 or 12 videos. And you just start drawing out these wiring, the wiring path from one, you know, from one port to another and so on and so forth. And before you know it, you have the full complete product. Obviously, there's a beginner level where you just make sure that you have all the things connected the way it is.
Yep.
And it looks fine. It will work fine. However, if you want to take it to the next level, then you will want to, you know, do stuff like shielding where you don't etch away all the copper from the plastic board. However, you only etch away the unnecessary copper off of the board. And that's a higher level of experience that you will want to get to down the line.
Cool. I can't see myself doing that anytime soon, but that sounds like it's neat. I'd love to see that sometime.
The whole processing stuff, it's processing these when you start, you know, etching these boards, it's really, really very, very interesting because if depending on how which method you go with, I like using like the photo light sensitive method, mm-hmm. where, you know, I just take like I actually have a red light bulb and I go into my bathroom and I, you know, bathe this copper board in there, and then when I'm done with it, I pretty much put it into acid and it will just dissolve away unnecessary parts. And one time my brother and I were doing this, and to dissolve away the copper shield, we were actually doing it in our garage. And it was probably about 8 in the evening, and the garage lights open, and you can see us opening and closing this thing, and we have these big industrial gas mask on our face.
So it's like Breaking Bad.
Yeah, it's almost like that. And we're running back and forth from
our house. So the cops show up thinking you have a meth lab.
Right. And then eventually we're like, we got to stop this now.
All right. Have you done anything interesting with home automation?
Actually, I have. I actually worked on a garage door opener probably about 2 years ago. I've tried using it with Node.js and obviously Windows 8 and Windows Phone on that to open and close garage doors. And the first iteration, we used an Arduino. The second iteration, I used the Arduino with a Wi-Fi module on it. Arduino is great, but if you want to make a product of your own, then you want to have a circuit board in it. You want to understand your circuitry that you can easily transfer to a circuit board. So they are both open source, just so people are aware. Mm-hmm. They're both open hardware, so you can easily find the schematics online for the Arduino chipset as well as the Arduino chipset, and you can make your own as well.
Cool. So what are you working on these days?
I'm still working on home automation stuff.
Okay.
Stuff around my house pretty much right now that I'm in the middle of prototyping.
Okay. And you're building most of that yourself?
I'm building most of it myself. And okay. And I'm using my own 3D printer on so that I can fit the right housing and stuff like that. So it's almost professional, I would say, but you know, it's not. It's,
so you're doing home automation on hardcore mode.
yeah. You could say that. The good thing is, you know, I got the 3D printer, which is really good. And it will pretty much put my projects, if I have the circuit board printed and everything else, then it's really tight and looks really like a finished product.
Okay,
which is really cool.
Oh yeah, I'm sure, totally.
And have you done anything with Raspberry Pi or Raspberry Pi 2?
I have used the Raspberry Pi, not 2. I need to get the 2. Oh, Jason's showing
up. You should see Min. He just about fell over because I showed him my Raspberry Pi 2.
Yeah, my heart sank when I saw it.
he just dropped his headphones and walked away. I think these are in stock now. I think you can get your hands on one.
Yeah, I do need to get a Raspberry Pi so that I can put Windows 10 when it comes out with IoT on it. That would be really, really cool to interface with it.
Yeah.
I think that's really going to open up a lot of, you know, potential for, you know, people who are used to programming for Windows. Now all of a sudden going to feel comfortable now that they have such a compact device like that to program against.
It's a little bit more palatable than, you know, Linux and C. You know, not that there's anything wrong with those, but it's just like you said, the Windows developers Yeah, this is going to feel much more at home to them.
The experience is also different. When I was writing on the Netduino stuff, I was able to, you know, put a breakpoint in the middle of my loop, and this is in the mid-cycle of the, you know, the microcontroller, and you're literally controlling the chip and saying, stop where you are. I'm going to see what variables are there and why it's breaking and all this stuff. Versus, you know, Arduino is much harder to, you know, put a breakpoint and stuff like that. So this is, the Windows IoT is going to change things for, you know, average people, like, you know, most of us that are, you know, just software developers.
Yeah. I mean, this thing, it's got a gig of RAM. It's $35. Mm-hmm. It's got, I mean, it's incredible because it's got, I'm going to take it out of the box here. Again, I have opened it before. I did just get this though. But it's got 4 USB ports on it. You know, they're all kind of jammed in there into a pretty small space. Ethernet, HDMI, audio, micro USB, and then it's got all these GPIO ports on it. I mean, for $35, it's just amazing. So I could, I mean, that's cheap enough that I mean, you could have, you know, 10 of these things around your house, and that wouldn't be that big of a stretch.
No. Actually, what I'm trying to get to, one of the projects I'm trying to get to is, I have a Raspberry Pi B Plus right now, which is the version before yours.
Yep.
There's two projects I'm working with that. One is nothing more than me using it to control my 3D printer, and the other is I want to use it as a centralized hub location where I can process all the heavy duty stuff. You know, to control the stuff to control the little microcontrollers. So it's going to be great to control. Something like a Raspberry Pi 2 is great, you know, if you want to connect to the internet, you know, do authentication, all this other stuff. The heavy lifting is going to be done on that.
Yeah, because it's got plenty of power. I mean, it looks small, but I mean, don't be, you know, discounting this thing, because it's a full computer with, you know, with a lot of power, especially when it comes to like headless things like that.
Right. It's because it gets much, much trickier and harder the more you try to stuff into a smaller microcontroller where it doesn't have as much processing power as well as, you know, memory and space, disk space. So something like this where, you know, the disk space is going to be expandable because of the SD card, it's going to be much, it will give you a lot more room to breathe and expand on your projects as much as you want.
Right. Cool. Is there anything else you wanted to mention before we move on?
Not at the top of my head right now.
Okay. Well, that means that our questions are pretty good and comprehensive.
if you want to start on, you know, working with low level microcontrollers, start with Arduino. You can find that on Arduino.cc.
Yep.
Another great place to find sample code as well as, you know, understand what you're buying in and, you know, read on product reviews is going to be SparkFun. Mm-hmm. SparkFun's great because a lot of the circuitry, they are also, you know, open hardware. So you can actually get the Eagle schematics off of there. So you can print your own circuitry.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And not only print, but expand out on what you have. So you can integrate. Let's just say, you know, I have a Arduino and I have a motor controller and I want to make a radio control car. I can put the two motor controller and Arduino circuitry together just by downloading the two of them online, which is going to be which will make your life a lot simpler and quicker to jumpstart. Another place that you can look up stuff is going to be Adafruit. Adafruit doesn't open the schematics from my experience as much, but they do have a great tutorial, and they have different libraries and stuff that you can download for your, you know, different uses. So those are really good places to check out your stuff.
Okay, very cool. Thank you. Let's see. Azure Pick of the Week. So this is actually a blog post from a colleague of mine. This is from Igor. This is called Azure SQL DB and SQL Server VM, how to make an equal cost comparison. So, you know, we get a lot of questions about SQL Server running in a virtual machine in Azure versus just run using the SQL database service that's available. So this helps break that down a little bit. And what's kind of cool about this is that the hosted version of SQL has really grown up over time, and it's gotten really powerful. What's neat about it, and some of the key things that he mentions here, is that whenever you first look at it, it looks like it's a lot more expensive. But whenever you start to really compare these things, you'll see that you get, with the hosted version, you get predictable performance. You're basically paying for the level of performance that you want. and you are getting things like high availability. So it's doing, you know, automatic replication, and it's also doing things where you can get point in time restore and things like that. Let's see what else. High availability, you get the disaster recovery. There's some compliance that it automatically meets. It's possible to do scale out. So being able to scale this thing up and down at pretty short notice is nice. And then also the ability to not worry about SQL licensing, because that's all bundled into that one price for the hosted version. And then again, just being able to scale up or down with the hosted version. So there's a couple different options there. So I recommend checking out this blog post. We'll have a link to it in the show notes, but it's just a great comparison if you've heard of SQL Database and you're not quite sure which one you want to use. And Carl, what do you got for the app of the week?
I have two apps of the week this week. The first one is called Concert Wall for Windows Phone. Okay. And I was in communication with the developer. Mm-hmm. Not going to mention his last name because I'm going to butcher it, but his name is Glenn. And on Twitter, it's @Depeshi is his Twitter handle. And this is actually a really awesome app. On the Outlooks, and I challenge everybody to just dig into it. On the Outlooks, you'll find music that's playing live in your area. So
that's cool.
Finding the nearby concerts. But as I dug into this, I found some other really cool side uses of this. So if you have a last.fm account, you can integrate with that. So it'll pull in all of that information from last.fm. It knows the venues. You can get directions to the venues. It knows, obviously the artists that will be there, and you can dig into the artist information and actually play their music. It'll open up Xbox music right to the artist CD or even, you know, song that you see from his app, and it'll deep link right into there and start playing it, which blew my mind. So I have, as a result, been using this to discover music that I would never have found otherwise. You can also pin venues and artists as secondary tiles to your start screen. A ton of features, and it's pretty well thought out. So, Glenn, great job. The second app of the week that I have this week is actually one that we've mentioned before, but it's coming out of beta. It's called Maestro, and it's a mail client for Windows Phone. They've been able to over the last few months, put a lot of thought and polish into it and get it kicked out of the door into, full mode. And unfortunately, for its first 24 hours, it was free. By the time that this podcast comes out, that will no longer be available. I don't know what the price is.
Oh, you should tweet that out just so.
It's already gone.
Oh, it says free on mine.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
So it's just for a little bit.
Says free for the first 24 hours, but it doesn't say when that started.
Yeah. So maybe I'll try to get that out as soon as the show's over, see if a few of you guys can get that for free. But if you're looking into something other than the built-in mail app, check out Maestro on Windows Phone.
Cool. And it's got the swiping where you can do the delete or archive. That's pretty cool.
I'll have to go download it on my Windows Phone.
Yeah. Get it while it's free. Okay, man, we play a game on here that you are aware of. Pick a number between 1 and 4, please.
3.
3. Okay. While stranded at sea, would you rather be on a good, safe boat with no food or be on an old, worn-out raft with a box of food?
I would say go with a safe boat. I can always break it down and figure out what I need to do to catch fish.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, could you get some fish somehow? Doesn't really say if you have, like, a net or anything.
Yeah, because, you know, if I'm on a, you know, broken down boat, then and I eat all my food, I'm kind of, you know, stranded.
Yeah. Well, it says a good safe boat. If it's a good boat, then just, you know, like, drive it somewhere.
Unless you don't have the keys for
whatever you call that with a boat. Okay, Carl, we'll pick a number.
One.
Would you rather be friends with a witch or a giant? Some of these are interesting.
I don't know. A giant's just a really big person. I mean,
they'd be asking you for food. And, yeah. Can you get the check this time, Carl?
No, you can't ride shotgun. No, that's not going to work. Yeah. You're going to tear the roof off. I don't, this is obviously for kids. I'll say witch.
Okay.
And maybe the witch can turn you into a giant or something.
And maybe she can.
Yeah, but then she would be the one that has the giant friend.
Well, maybe she can whip me up a good safe boat and some food.
Well, then send it to Min. I heard that he needs it. Okay, Min, where can people find you? Carl has like 30 links in here, but what's the best place for people to find you online?
The best place right now would be you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm on there. Otherwise, you can also try to contact me through Twitter. You can contact me at I am Min Maung.
Okay.
IAMMINMAUNG.
Okay, we'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Yep. Or you can find my blogs that I occasionally post at bytecode.com.
Cool. I'll have to check that out. And Carl, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Carl Schweitzer or at WPDevGuy.com.
Excellent. You can find me at ytechie.com or you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/ytechie. Min, thanks again for coming on the show. It's awesome talking to you about robots and robotics.
Thank you for having me.
Be sure to subscribe by searching for MS Dev Show in your favorite podcasting app. Leave us a review at iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast aggregator of choice. Visit us at msdevshow.com where you can leave comments, check out our links, show notes, and more. Visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/msdevshow. You can send us your comments and feedback directly to feedback@msdevshow.com.